بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. Brothers and sisters and friends, I greet you with the warmest Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Which basically means may the peace and blessings of God, of Allah, be upon you all. It's very nice seeing you today. Today I'm going to be talking to you about the path to God. And the context that we're going to be talking about the path to God is the context of us using our minds and using our hearts. Because the mind and the heart in the Islamic spiritual and intellectual tradition has great importance. When anybody reads the Quran, the book of Allah, you see that Allah wants to address you as a human being. It doesn't want to change your state. It wants to basically address you as you deserve to be addressed. Meaning that the human being is made of an aql, of an intellect, and a nafsiyah, a disposition, a psychological disposition. And this is the human being. He has emotions, feelings, desires, wants and needs, a psychology, and he also has an intellect. And he's driven by both of those realities. That's the human being. And when you study the Qur'an, and it is important to study the Qur'an because the Islamic tradition is a scholarly tradition. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, upon whom be peace, said that the inheritors to the prophets are the ulama, are the scholars. So this tradition has to be seen through scholarly eyes. You can't just look at our tradition in a kind of reductionist way. We reduce the Qur'an and what the Prophet upon whom be peace said just to a few lines. You have to see things holistically. And when you study the Qur'an, you see that essentially the Qur'an wants to address our minds and wants to address our internal psychological disposition. And it's as if the Qur'an gives us a path to Him. And this path is through tadabbur, pondering, through reasoning, through understanding, through a scholarly exercise by engaging with the book of Allah. And maybe it's no wonder Allah, God says in the Qur'an, do they not reflect upon the Qur'an, or are there locks on their hearts? So this gives us an indication that the more we reflect upon the book of Allah, the more our hearts become unlocked to receive His mercy and His guidance. So it's very important that we see the Qur'an from this perspective, that the Qur'an essentially is a book for the human being, to guide the human being, and it addresses his intellectual capacities and his emotional capacities. And from this perspective, you'll understand and maybe conclude that the Qur'an, the book of Allah, is a very intrusive book. It wants to intrude and impose itself on the inner dimensions of man. As we said, his intellect and his psychology. But this intrusion, this imposition is not negative, it's very positive. And the way the Qur'an attempts to impose itself on the human being positively is by asking questions. And this is so important because the Qur'an uses questions to almost guide the heart and mind of the human being. Because if you ask the right questions, you get the right answers that lead to the truth. And this is very important. And that's why when you study the Qur'an, and I want this to be a session for you to be encouraged to study the Qur'an. When you study the Qur'an, you see that when it talks about man, life and the universe, when the Qur'an talks about creation, when the Qur'an talks about animals, the cosmos, the orbits, the universe, it does so in a way not to conclude abstractly, not to conclude in an abstract way. Oh, look at the orbit, isn't that amazing? No, that's not what the Qur'an tries to achieve. The Qur'an talks about these realities in a way to show you that there is a pervading wisdom in the universe. There is a wisdom in the universe, there's a wisdom in creation, there's a purpose, an intention, an intelligence, a mathematical structure, and therefore the one who created this, the one who put this into play, the one who designed this, the one who allows us to discover the design, is the one that deserves to be worshipped. And this is very significant because the Quran, it asks these questions and makes you ponder about reality to form that conclusion that yes, not only does something create the universe, a power create the universe, but this power, this being deserves to be worshipped because he created me. And it's very important for us to understand the Quran from that perspective. So when you look at these verses, there are so many verses that talk about man, life and the universe to make you think about your own existence, to make you think about the wisdom behind the universe and creation behind the universe. Now the reason I'm focusing on this is for you to understand that the Quran is not a book that just wants you to accept it blindly. The Quran doesn't want you to do this. The Quran appreciates the human being as the human being. We're not going to be blindly following concerning huge things like religion and the afterlife. And what's very interesting about the Quran is not only does it make people think, but it encourages further thought. And it's no wonder the professor Rosalind Wood Gwynn, in her book concerning logic and the Quran, she concludes that reasoning and argument are so integral in the Quran that it shaped the very consciousness of Quranic scholars. And we see how the Quran actually changed the world based upon its profound questions, based upon its teachings and its values, and the fact that it encourages people to think. We need to study our history because these Quranic values actually shaped Western science. For example, who knows the name of the first scientist? It's not Albert Einstein. It's a good guess, but it's not Albert Einstein. The first scientist was called Ibn al-Haytham. According to historians of science, such as David C. Lindbergh and others, they conclude that the first scientist was Ibn al-Haytham. Now, Ibn al-Haytham wrote a book about optics, the Book of Optics. And in this book, it was the first manifestation of the formal scientific method in terms of experimentation and analyzing the data. Yes, there were other people who loved science, like the Greeks before the Arabs, before the Muslims, who developed the science to a certain degree. But Ibn al-Haytham was the first formal scientist. And in Ibn al-Haytham's biography, he discusses and says that the reason he developed this, because he thought that knowing more about God's creation will get you closer to God. Not only that, he was a practicing Muslim himself. And he said he was encouraged by the Quranic principles and values and thinking in order to look into the interconnecting principles of nature. So the first scientist was not only a Muslim, but he was encouraged by his own spiritual tradition. He was encouraged by the power of the Quran. This is something you don't learn in school. You have to study this in academia, right? And this is very interesting because we should be proud of this, that our tradition has created such people, which essentially was the basis for Western scientific revolution and renaissance. And it's true what I'm saying, because if you read the works of Professor Thomas Arnold, who was a historian and Arabist, he wrote the book, The Preaching of Islam. On page 131, he basically says that Muslim Spain, that was affected by the Quranic values and principles, was the first state that established that needed tranquility, if you like, that facilitated the thinking of the Europeans up to the time of the Renaissance. This is profound, that an Islamic environment like Islamic Spain was one of the causes for European enlightenment, European Renaissance and thinking. This is very significant. Even the founder of capitalism, Adam Smith, the 18th century founder, in one of his essays, and you can find this in the book called Adam Smith's Essays, He basically says that the empire of the Muslims, of the caliphs, was the first state that had that needed tranquility in order for people to look into the interconnecting principles of nature. Meaning that these people were encouraged by an environment based on the tolerance of Islam, based on the progress of Islam, the progressive thinking of the Quran and the prophetic traditions, for us to look into the interconnecting principles of nature. This created the environment for Muslims and non-Muslims to become scientists. Because if you look and study Islamic history, it doesn't have the same baggage as Europe. Now, if you study European history, when you saw the Catholic Church was in power, it used the coercive arm of the state to prevent any thinking that was incongruous, that was against its own doctrine. And this facilitated the likes of Martin Luther, who pegged on a church door in Wittenberg his thesis attacking the Catholic tradition. And that facilitated the Protestant movement, and because of other trade laws and so many different historical realities, that Europe was in blood, essentially. Neck high. You had the 80-year wars, the 30-year wars, the massacre on St. Bartholomew's Day. I mean, it was crazy stuff. And from there you had the post-enlightenment movement, and you had thinkers who were moving away from religion, and that's why you had Professor Charvet from London School of Economics, in his book The Liberal Project, he basically says that this made thinkers move away from God's view on society to an individualistic view on society. So they wanted to move away from God's will in terms of what God wanted for society, because God wasn't working. If you study European history, the Catholic Church wasn't working from a political perspective. There was no progress, there was oppression, etc. But Islam never suffered that baggage, and that's why when we talk to Europeans, talk to people in the West, we're living in the West, we have to educate them and make them understand that you can't use a specific historical issue and actually apply it to the Islamic narrative, because it's not exactly the same. So the reason I'm saying this is I want you to be encouraged that actually the path to God from this perspective is a path of progress, is a path of thinking, is a path of wisdom. And when people use the Quranic principles and values properly, it changed the world. We had the European Renaissance, we had the first scientist, Ibn al-Haytham. And this is very significant for us to understand, brothers, because it gives us some kind of historical kind of grounding and some kind of confidence in our own tradition to show that, you know, we have an amazing tradition. It's no wonder the artistic critic Jean-Jacques Lévesque, he basically argues that don't think in history Muslims were crossing borders and taking over the world because they like the drink of non-Muslim blood. Yeah? They were doing this because they were encouraged to look into the horizons by the Quran. And the Quran says this. And in the horizons we will show you our signs, and in yourselves until you know that this is the truth. They were encouraged by this. This is Jean-Jacques Lévesque, artistic critic. So when it comes to progress and thinking and science, we have to understand this is an inherently an Islamic product. I'm not saying it was only because of Islam. Yes, the Greeks were involved, the Indians were involved, other civilizations were involved. But without a doubt, when you look at various historians of science, you see that Europe is indebted to the Islamic tradition and the Arabs specifically, because they used the Islamic culture and the principles, and it was implemented socially and politically, that encouraged people to look into the sciences. That's why Ibn Sina, he was one of the products of this environment. Ibn Sina, he was a famous scientist, and he wrote the book, The Canon of Medicine, which was used in Europe for around 600 years. For 600 years. And not only did the Islamic environment produce Muslim scholarship, but it produced non-Muslim scholarship. Consider, for example, Maimonides, also known as Musa bin Maimun. He was a Jew living in Islamic Spain. He was a product of the Islamic environment, to the point where the Jewish tradition considers him as the second Moses. He was like a big figure, an intellect of the Jewish tradition. Him being a product of Islamic Spain. Because Islamic Spain wasn't some kind of historical accident. It used the Quran and the prophetic traditions to formulate a society that was based on a convivencia. What does that mean? Convivencia means a coexistence. And we see this directly in the Quran and the prophetic traditions. The Quran encourages thinking, for example. It says, do you not use your intellect? Do you not examine the heavens and the earth? And how they emerged, how they came into being. The Quran talks about justice. The Quran says, indeed Allah loves the just, loves people who are just and equitable. The Quran talks about tolerance, bringing peoples together. The prophetic traditions, the statements of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, talk about minority politics. When you look at the Treaty of Najran, for example, this was unprecedented in 7th century history. You have the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, essentially having a treaty with the minority Christians, saying that you should not oppress them, you should take care of them, you should give them their rights. This predated the likes of Erasmus of Rotterdam, that influenced treaties of tolerance in Europe and in Britain. And this is our Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said, whoever harms a non-Muslim under our protection is like harming the Prophet himself. So these are values and principles showing to us that we want tolerance and a coexistence between different peoples. So these teachings are not accidental. They influence societies like Islamic Spain, which therefore influence its own people to have the sciences. And what's very interesting is when the Christians took over Toledo, they took over Islamic Spain essentially, they found so many manuscripts on astronomy, on physics, on mathematics, on literature, on poetry. And many European scholars traveled there, took those manuscripts and translated them. And this facilitated the Renaissance, this facilitated European thinking, because it encouraged them. To the point where some historians even say that the great Oxford University in Britain was as a result of Islamic Spain, essentially. You had Adelard of Bath and Daniel of Morley. They were influenced by the Islamic tradition in Islamic Spain. One of them even traveled there, I believe, and took some manuscripts and took it back to Oxford and built the first institution that is now called Oxford University. I mean, this is not a historical accident, this is not a joke. So this should make you realize, brothers, that we should not have an inferiority complex, that our religion, our tradition doesn't suffer from some of the historical baggage of maybe the Christian West, where there was a clash between thinking, science, progress, and religion. Islam actually encouraged that. However, with that in mind, I want to give you some concepts and principles for you to understand, so you can apply when you go to college, when you're in high school, when you read books or go to the internet, to understand this whole science stuff. Now, yes, Islam is progressive, it encourages science, it doesn't deny it, and it all wants to create scientists. But at the same time, it wants you to be intellectual. It doesn't want you to be blind. It doesn't want you to now adopt another religion, the religion of the white coats, you know, the guys in the lab. They become like the new priests these days. You have something in the Detroit news, you know, scientists say coffee is good for you. That's it, we're going to Starbucks now. We hear it and we obey. We don't become critical in our thinking. So a Muslim, from an epistemic perspective, what does epistemic mean? It means essentially knowledge, from a perspective of knowing things and getting to know things. We're not restricted with just one methodology. We're very wide. We don't have an epistemic prison. We're not imprisoned epistemically. Our knowledge is not imprisoned. We don't just use one pathway to knowledge. We use various mental methodologies to come and form conclusions about reality and the world and about things. So we don't just use science. We use philosophy. We use logic. We use reasoning. We use spirituality. We use testimony. We use mathematics. We use a whole range of tools at our disposal. We don't just focus on one. Because focusing on one leads to disaster. Because, for example, can you say science is the only method that forms conclusions about things? No. Science is not the only way to knowledge and truth. It has a specific methodology. Because science, for example, can can only deal with the how, it cannot deal with the why. Science can't tell you why I came here. Science can't tell you what my intentions are. Science can tell you how I came here, but not why I came here. For example, if my mother baked you a beautiful cake, science can tell you how the cake was made, the temperature used, the ingredients used, the kind of chemical bonding involved, the molecular structure of the chemical ingredients. But science can never tell you why my mother baked your cake. The how and the why are two different things. And this is why when people attack religion or attack Islam, generally speaking, they basically think, look, Islam says earthquakes are because of God's test or God's punishment. But we know earthquakes happen because of tectonic plate theory. Agreed. But you see what they've done here? They think the why is the same as the how. There are two different things. And we need to differentiate this and make people understand that the religion explains the why and it encourages for you to know the how. I remember speaking with Professor Hoodboy. He's in Pakistan, he's a well-known academic. Doesn't seem like a religious guy. He basically had the same kind of contention against the Quran. And I said, look, let me give you an example. How are babies formed? How? What's the science of babies? You have sperm. For example, my children were born because of my spermatoza. Came together with the egg. And then you had cell division. And then you had the blastocyst. Then it basically embedded itself in the uterine wall. And then you had it growing into an embryo. Then you had neurulation. You have the folding of the embryo. And you have all of these processes happening, biological processes. And after 9 months, you have a baby. That's the how, right? Why was the baby born? Why was the baby born? Let's be honest, brothers. I find my wife attractive. Right? There's the why and the how. There are two different things. You can't make them the same. And this is why we have to understand that science is very limited. It can't deal with the why. It deals with the how. For example, another example is, consider a car. We know how the car works. You have an engine, you have combustion, you have the spark plugs, etc. That's the how. But why does it work that way? Why is it moving? Because someone has intentionally gone into the car, put the key in, turned the ignition on, and he intends to go to a certain destination. So the point is, the how and the why are two different things, okay? And see, and the reason I'm giving you this is because I want you to be critical thinkers, not just to fall for the new narrative that's online at the moment that makes you want to think that it's either science or religion. No. So that was the first point, the why and the how are two different things. The second point is, science doesn't give you all knowledge, especially when it comes to things like morality. Science can't tell you what's good or bad. It just can't. It's not its domain. It's not its methodology. Science can only tell you what is, not what ought to be. Do you understand? Science can tell you what is, but it can't tell you what ought to be. So it tells you about the how, the physical reality of things, the processes involved. But it can't tell you how things should be. For example, if I were to stab someone, right? Science can tell you the is, which is, it's a very sharp object, it's penetrated through the skin, it's created a wound, as a result you're bleeding, and this is the process happening at the moment, etc., etc. But science doesn't necessarily, it can't necessarily tell you what ought to be. It can't say, based on a scientific process, or biological process, or something physical, now science can tell you, you should never stab someone. Right? They're two different things. Science doesn't have that domain. That's why many people, they say, many thinkers and philosophers and even scientists say science is amoral. It doesn't mean they're immoral. It means it's amoral. It can't deal with moral realities. It just can tell you what is. It can't tell you what ought to be. And this is very important for us to understand. Yes, science can inform our moral decisions when we consider pain and pleasure. It can inform, but it can't give you the basis, the foundation for morality. Because think about it, if our morals were just as a result of evolution, then our morals don't have any meaning anymore. Even Charles Darwin, he wrote about this in the 19th century, and he gave a very kind of striking example about the beehives. And he said, if human beings were to be reared under the same conditions as the beehives, then we would think it's okay to kill our fertile daughters. Now, if you use that example and imagine that human beings were just a result of the same biological processes as the nurse shark, then we may think it's okay to rape our women. Because that's what the nurse shark does, according to National Geographic. It forces itself on its mate. So from this perspective, if we're just a reaction to biological processes, then morals don't have any real meaning. Even Professor Michael Ruse, who's an atheist, he basically says, don't think that when you say love thyself as thy neighbor, you're referring to something above and beyond yourself. It's a survival reproduction. Ethics, morals have no true meaning. It's illusory. And if our morals are dependent on biological changes, then they're not objective. They don't have any real sense. So from that perspective, science can't really ground your morals. Not only can't it tell you what you ought to do, but it can't provide the basis of what you ought to do. Because it would always be changing, or it won't have much meaning because it's based on just some cold, non-moral, material processes. So the how and the why is different. Science can't tell you what ought to be, can only tell you what is. Science is amoral from that perspective. Another thing that's very important is science is not the only way to form conclusions about things, because there are other sources of knowledge. If we study epistemology, which is basically the study of belief, the study of knowledge, you see there are various sources of knowledge. Memory, introspection, experience, and another one is testimony, the say-so of others. Now this is very interesting, because not many people take this very seriously, but it's a huge kind of study now amongst the philosophers, which is testimony, that we believe the say-so of others. We think everything we believe in is scientific. That's not true. Most of your beliefs is based on the say-so of others. Let me give you some evidence. I want you in here, in this room, to prove to me that China exists. If you've never been to China before, and I assume you haven't been to China before, prove to me China exists. I'll give you $100.
I can't get you a map.
Okay, so the brother said he could get me a map. But is that scientific proof? What if I drew you another map, 2015 version, and I drew a diamond island in the Pacific Ocean, and I said this island is called the island of Fufula, and I'm a Fufulonian. Would you believe me? That's not real evidence. So how do you know China exists? He said other people have gone there. But that's not proof for him, because he has to believe that what they said, that they've actually gone there. Google Maps? Well, so all of a sudden on this area on Google Maps, just because it says China, it means China does exist. What if you rubbed it out and the 2016 version said, well, China is not China anymore, we're going to call it Flu-flu-flan, right? Chinese people. Yeah, but Chinese people, they're just saying they're Chinese. It's not proof that they're Chinese. I could say to you, hey, I'm Pakistani. But I'm not, I'm Greek. That looks Pakistani. So the point is, people could just make claims. You don't have any real empirical evidence that China exists. Now you may say, oh, but I can't take a plane and go to China. But that's not evidence, because there are two things here. The first thing is, your belief now that China exists is not based upon the possibility of you going there. And you thinking that there is a possibility of you getting on a plane to go to China, that's still based on testimony, the say-so of other people, because you have to believe other people that you can get on a plane and eventually go to a place called China. So the point here is, many of our beliefs is based on the say-so of others. And this is not a real problem, because many philosophers have understood this now. Professor C.A. Cody, Professor Keith Lehrer, Professor Elizabeth Fricker, Assistant Professor Benjamin McMiller, and many others have understood that we believe in the say-so of other people. It's fundamental to knowledge. It's fundamental. I'll give you another example. Prove to me the world is round. $100. Go to space. Your belief that the world is round is not based on the possibility that you can go to space. Prove to me the world is round. So you're going to say pictures, right? Again, that's testimony. You have to believe that is a picture of the earth. Right? The horizon doesn't prove the world is round. Maybe it's a semicircle. It's a slight curve and there's a semicircle. Even if you go on the highest top of the mountains and there's a slight curvature, it doesn't mean much. Maybe it's a little curve and there's another straight line. Geography. Yeah, well, you still have to believe the books. That's the say-so of others.
I mean, it's not an answer, but science. Some scientists theorize or discover the earth was round.
Well, still they say so. It's just, you just have to believe what they said.
The solar system is like all, like Mercury, Venus, they're all round, just like the earth.
So Mercury, Venus, so therefore the earth must be round as well. That's not proof. It's just an inference. See, just because the moon is round, Jupiter is round, the sun is round, khalas, the world is round as well. Google Maps, that still say so. That's not your evidence. You have to believe that someone took a picture and that's a picture of the earth. Just because a million people have done it, it doesn't mean it's true.
How about seeing the top of the ships on the water before the bottom?
Sorry?
How about seeing the top of the ships before the bottom on the water?
So you're saying there's a slight curvature. It doesn't mean it's round. It could be a semicircle, as we said. Now, the point I'm trying to say here, brothers, is basically, fundamentally, there's nothing to be ashamed of. We have to rely on experts and authorities. Even Dr. Elizabeth Fricker, she says, given my limitations as parametric, I have to basically believe in the say-so of others, take it seriously as a form of knowledge. Without the say-so of others, you can't have knowledge. Even science will never progress, because some science is reliant upon the workings of other people, which you didn't do yourself, and you have to believe that they did it. Testimony, the say-so of others, is fundamental. So it goes to show that science is not the only method to form conclusions about truth. We have other sources of knowledge, like testimony, the say-so of others. Now the reason I'm giving you these concepts, brothers, is for you to understand that you shouldn't be disheartened when you see some scientific stuff that might go against your own religion. And this leads me to how science forms conclusions about things. I want to focus on two things. Number one, induction, and number two, empiricism. Now, induction is a thinking process that science uses. It basically takes a limited set of observations and it concludes for the next observation. This is called induction. So you have limited observation, you conclude for the next. For example, you've observed 100 white sheep. Your conclusion is the next observation of sheep is going to be white. Because everything you've seen is white so far. Now, this is a thinking process, but it's limited. Because you can have a future observation that contradicts previous conclusions. If I've seen 1,000 white sheep, it doesn't mean the next sheep I'm going to see is white. I might have a black sheep, right? So that shows that there is a limited kind of thinking process going on here. And it's like very important for us to understand. Another thing science uses is a theory of knowledge called empiricism. Now empiricism is essentially a theory of knowledge that says that you should only have ideas or concepts about something if you experience them or it. So it's based on experience, direct or indirect observation. Again, by understanding this theory of knowledge, it's limited. Because you're never going to have an infinite number of observations. You may have a future observation that contradicts previous conclusions. And we've seen this in the history of science. The scientists thought it was absolutely true that the universe never had a beginning. Then they changed their mind after the 1960s, right? Because they see new observations which contradicts previous conclusions. So when there's something that so-called goes against religion, you shouldn't be upset or thinking, oh my God, my religion's not true anymore, Islam's not true anymore. Why? Because science is supposed to change. That's the whole beauty of science. It's transient. It's based upon time, based upon more observation and understanding. And sometimes we'll agree with the religion, sometimes it won't, but it's not a big deal. Because we believe the Quran is the full wisdom of God. Not the full wisdom of God, but it's come from God and His wisdom and His knowledge. It's His eternal word. So this knowledge is what you would call the totality of knowledge. And human knowledge is only particular. In other words, God has the picture, we just have the pixel. God has the puzzle, we just have one small fragmentary piece of the puzzle. And it always changes based on the new information that we have. So if there is some kind of contradiction, you should never be upset. Because you know the Quran has come from the divine, is based on full knowledge and wisdom. But yet human knowledge, even if it's scientific, can still change. And we've seen it in the history of science. And this is something very important. Now you may think, yeah, but science works. But that's true. But just because things work, it doesn't mean they're true. Do you know this? Just because things work, it doesn't mean they're absolutely true. And we see this with Newtonian physics and quantum physics. Newtonian physics is not absolutely true. Because when you study Newtonian physics, you understand this. But yes, we do see the law of gravity, you see laws of motion, and it works. We have this building, for example, that we trust. We trust the foundations of the building. Now, just because it works, it doesn't mean it's absolutely true, because Newtonian physics doesn't apply to everything, especially when it comes to things going towards high speeds, like towards the speed of light. And also when you go into quantum physics, it's a different reality. It almost doesn't obey the laws of Newton, if you like. And yet they haven't found the link between Newtonian physics and quantum physics. But it works. It's not absolutely true, but it works. So not everything that works is absolutely true. There could be some amendments and changes. And this is something very important for us to understand. And even if you think, yeah, but all the scientists believe in evolution, for example. But just because there is a consensus, it doesn't mean it's also true. Because if you look at the history of science, there are so many consensus that was happening. For example, there was a disease called pellagra. And many of the scientists said there is a consensus that this is to do with infection. One scientist basically said, no, it has nothing to do with infection, it's to do with nutrition. They all laughed at him. But after many years, after a few years, they found out that he was right. So dogma and thinking just because all the scientists come together and agree on something is actually quite anti-scientific. Because it prevents future progress. And this is something very important for you to really understand from this perspective. So I'm going to give you these tools to really understand that it shouldn't give you shubahat, it shouldn't give you doubts about your religion just because, you know, a scientist said something. Now, you may argue, well, hang on a second, Hamza, there is an assumption here. Yes, you're right about the philosophy of science is limited, it's not going to be absolutely true, it can change. But you're assuming that the Quran is based from God, does come from God. And this is something that you need to start to understand. That actually the Quran is not only a book that makes you think, but we have an array of evidence to show good reasons that the Quran is from Allah. You remember when I said the Quran doesn't want you to be a blind thinker? The Quran challenges mankind. In the second chapter, in the 23rd verse, the Quran says, if you are in doubt about this book we have sent down to our servant, referring to the Prophet Muhammad upon him be peace, then bring one chapter like it and call on your witnesses and supporters besides God if you're truthful in your claim. This is a challenge to the whole of mankind. And this opens an array of evidence, a window of evidence to show good reasons why the Quran is from God. And there are many reasons for you to explore. The Quran is a linguistic miracle. The Quran gives you history that was lost in the 7th century. The Quran has an amazing structure. So let me just focus on these things, these three things very quickly. Just for you to be encouraged, to plant seeds in your heart and mind to do your own further research. Number one, the linguistic miracle. The Quran was revealed in the 7th century, where in the Arabian Peninsula, that 7th century Arabs were the best at expressing themselves in the Arabic language. The Quran came and challenged them and said, look, this Quran is a unique form of the Arabic language. You can't produce anything like it. And what's interesting, the best Arabs at the time who were best placed to challenge the Quran, they failed. And it's quite interesting, but they had so much motivation to try and challenge the Quran. Because the Quran really wanted to told them to stop worshipping 360 gods, said worship only one God, don't worship creation, worship the Creator. The Quran basically said, don't stop doing injustice, stop treating women bad, have economic fairness. This went against the grain of Arabian society of the time, and it affected the economy. So they were politically motivated to try and challenge the Quran. But the academic Navid Kermani, in the book, The Blackwell Companion to the Quran, he makes a beautiful point. He says, obviously the Prophet Muhammad succeeded against the best poets of the time, the best linguists of the time, because otherwise Islam wouldn't have spread like wildfire. Because if the Quran was wrong in its claim that it was a linguistic superior text, then the Arabs would never have accepted it. But since the Arabs accepted it, then it shows the Quran is linguistically superior. It couldn't come from a human being, must have come from the divine. And this is a very simple summary of the argument. Another argument is that there is history in the Quran that was lost in the 7th century. And all other books got history wrong. Take for example the leader of the Egyptians mentioned in the Quran. Now there are two titles for the leader of the Egyptians in the Quran. One title is King, Al-Malik, and the other title is Pharaoh. There are two titles for the leader of the Egyptians in the Quran. But in the Bible and the Torah, they got it wrong. The way they used the titles was wrong, historically. But the Quran specifically uses these two titles for specific times. When the Quran says Al-Malik, the King, it's for the time of Joseph. When the Quran says Pharaoh, Firaun in Arabic, it's for the time of Moses, which is the new kingdom in Egyptian history. And Joseph is the old middle kingdom. And what's very interesting is this, that the word Pharaoh was used in the old kingdom, and the word king was used, but the word king was used for the leader of the Egyptians, and Pharaoh was only referring to the government palace. But in the time of Moses in the new kingdom, it changed. Pharaoh was starting to be used not only for the palace, but for the leader of the Egyptians as well, which is in line with the accuracy of the Quran. Because at the time of Joseph, the old middle kingdom refers to the leader of the Egyptians as king, and changes it at the time of Moses to Pharaoh, which is in line with Egyptian history. And in the 7th century Arabia, they never knew this Egyptian history. In actual fact, Egyptian history was dead, because the hieroglyphs, the pictorial language of the Egyptians, was a dead language. We only found out how to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics over 1,000 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. So the Quran reveals lost knowledge. Another interesting aspect of the Quran, and this is the third or final point, there's many other things to talk about, but because of time, I just want to encourage you to do your own research. That the Quran has its own unique structure. If you study the history of the Quran, you see the Quran was revealed over how many years? 23 years. And the Quranic verses were revealed for specific times and places, okay? But yet the Quran was compiled together in amazing structure. Take for example the longest chapter in the Quran, Surah Baqarah. The chapter called The Cow. 286 verses. If you do a karate chop in the middle, you have the 143rd verse, and you find the word middle. And what's very interesting is Surah Baqarah has something called ring composition. What is ring composition? Ring composition is that you have a mirror in the middle of a text, and the mirror reflects the themes of the previous sentences, if you like, or there's previous paragraphs. So it would be like a mirror, a ring composition. So you'd have A will be reflected to A1, B will reflect B1, B2, so C2 reflect, C1 reflect C, D1 reflect D, and E would be in the middle, for example. And you have this mirror structure of themes. Now what's interesting is Surah Baqarah has this ring composition. And that's so amazing. Because think about it, this Quran was revealed for specific times and places to address specific issues over a long period of time. Yet when it's compiled back together, it has its own unique structure that's coherent. This can only mean that the author knew the future. Because how can you start writing the conclusion, then start writing the middle, going back to the introduction, going back to the conclusion, going back into the middle, writing all haphazardly, and yet it's compiled in a unique structure that makes sense. And yet those verses were revealed for specific times and circumstances and problems and issues throughout the period of revelation. This can only mean the author knew the future, which makes sense of God. So these are some indicators for you to, you know, be encouraged to understand that the Quran is quite special and it couldn't have come from a human being. There are many things to talk about, but I just want to encourage your heart and mind from this perspective. So just to summarize everything we've said so far. Number one, Quran makes you think. Quran encouraged a civilization that produced the first scientists, that encouraged European science and the Renaissance. Science is not the only method to form conclusions about things. Can't deal with morality. You have other sources of knowledge like testimony. And science is limited. It's not the gospel truth, if you like. Because if you study induction and empiricism, it shows that you can't have future observations that contradict previous conclusions. Also, science can tell you the how, doesn't deal with the why. So these concepts should help you really reconcile the mess that you find on the web these days and things that you read in literature. And also, the Quran is a very special book. We gave a few reasons for you to be encouraged to investigate yourself. It's a linguistic miracle. It reveals lost historical knowledge. And it has a unique structure, even though it's revealed over a 23-year period for specific times and places. So this should encourage you to increase your faith, to give you the right tools to be able to navigate in this mess that you find online at the moment and the literature that we read. People think it's science versus religion, but when you study what we just studied today, which is the philosophy of science, which is the Quran itself and Islamic history, you see actually that's not the case. Science and Islam are together, science and reasoning are together, and I give you the tools to understand if there is something scientific that goes against the Quran itself, because you understand science changes over time. The Quran is from the all-wise, the all-knowing. God has the picture, we just have the pixel. So hopefully I've given you food for thought and encourage you to do your further research and thinking. And it's very good to speak to you guys about these very interesting topics. Because when you go to high school and college and university, they're going to be very important. And you might go back to this video and say, you know what? He helped me. May God bless you guys. I'm assuming it's a quick Q&A. And I'm going back to sleep. I'm jet lagged. JazakAllah for listening.
Is it safe to say then, Islam doesn't believe in blind faith, that to some degree, I mean, just because you're born Muslim or Allah says something, you still use your head, still use your intellect, and why does it teach this? Why does it say this? Don't just say, you know, I do
it
because I'm Muslim.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Islam always encouraged thinking. And when it comes to matters of belief, there is no blind faith. Yes, some things can be natural. You don't have to justify everything intellectually because, you know, this religion is a religion of fitrah, which means the religion of nature. We know it to be true because it's true. It's self-evident. But what's very interesting is at the same time, Islam encourages thinking and questioning. And this is something that we have to understand ourselves. We shouldn't just be socialized as Muslims. The only reason you're Muslim is because your mom's Muslim. Sometimes we need to start thinking about where we're going, who we are, why we are. Especially in the Western context. To encourage for you to have a stronger faith and be more convinced. And it would encourage you to be able to research and learn further to be able to protect your religion intellectually. And this is very, very important. So yeah, you're right. Islam encourages thinking. It doesn't mean though that you have to be a PhD student and know philosophy. No, it doesn't mean these things. But within your own personal power and capacity, do your own thinking. Reflect and ponder. Even the Quran says, يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. For those who reflect, who ponder, who think deeply about things. So, be thinkers. It doesn't mean you reject authority. So when it comes to rulings, we have to listen to our ulama, our scholars, because we don't have the knowledge that they have. We don't have the tools that they have to understand the religion properly when it comes to rulings. But when it comes to matters of like belief and faith and the cosmos, think. And this is one of our problems as an ummah, as a community at the moment, is that we've suspended sometimes our critical thinking, our ability to have discussion in a tolerant way, our ability to communicate with one another. It's very important to not be judgmental and think it's my way or the highway. You know, we have these type of Muslims usually, which is unfortunate. It's my way or the highway. You know, we have this kind of like arrogance. We arrogate to ourselves, you know, the kind of status of godliness. That's not true. The only people that can tell you what to do is Allah and His Messenger. No one else can tell you what to do in Islam. No one. Only Allah and His Messenger. We don't believe in fascism. We want to encourage thinking and thought. And that's the power of the Quran. When it plants seeds in your heart and mind, it gives you the right questions to think about. Sometimes the Quran doesn't give you answers, it gives you the question. Sometimes the Quran just gives you the answer, the question. Because if you use the question correctly, it will plant the right seed to grow into the fruits of faith. This is very important for us to, you know, really think. And that's why I want to give you these concepts about science and religion, so you could apply them in your day-to-day scenario, what you read at school, at college, at university, what you see on the internet. So you could have these concepts that deal with these issues. Because the amount of questions I get by Muslims who are clever, and I get these really mundane, basic questions like, haven't you thought about this before? People are suspending their thinking when it comes to religion, or they suspend their mind because they're lazy. Because when they think about these things, they won't get to give them money. Because you know, they don't have that motivation. So yeah, thinking is very important, for sure, 100%. Yes, sir.
Jazakallah khairan for the talk. Could you please clarify the verses in the Quran that talk about natural theology and the verses where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says الَّذِينَ يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ and where Allah tells us سَمِعْنَا وَأَطَعْنَا and
yes,
all these verses.
Okay, the brother is saying there is a difference between the verses of the Quran talks about natural theology, man, life, the universe, the mountains, the orbits, the stars, the moon, the cosmos. And when the Quran talks about belief in the unseen, and you hear and you obey. Now, this is very interesting about the Qur'an. The Qur'an, from a creedal perspective, wants you to establish that this book is from Allah. That the universe was created by God, who is Al-Hakim, who is the wise, and He deserves to be worshipped. Allah says, know that God is one. So Allah is encouraging by using His signs in the universe that they are an indication to the one who created those signs. Once you've established that God exists and He deserves to be worshipped, and the Qur'an is from the Divine, then you hear and you obey. That's the most rational thing to do. If I knew that you were a mathematics professor, and I wanted to learn maths, I'm not going to go to my 7-year-old child and ask for theories on calculus. I want to go to you, because you're the authority. If you've established Allah is the authority via the Qur'an, then who are you to now muck about with it? He is the authority, He is Al-Hakim, He has the totality of wisdom. So we hear, we obey. And we believe in the unseen because God, via testimony, His say-so, and we know the say-so of others is valid source of knowledge, and if it's come from God, then He knows better than you do. And if He says there is the unseen, then you believe in the unseen. It's not blind faith. Belief in the unseen is not blind faith. Belief in angels is not blind faith. Because we know who said it, it was God. We could prove His existence, we could show that He deserves to be worshipped, and we could show that this book is from Him. If we could show this, then if He says there's angels, there's angels. So there's the difference. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Can you give us a few ideas to approach a Muslim to invite Islam for this viewpoint? You are expert in this field?
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert in the field, but look, it's very important. The way we talk to non-Muslims is, we first have to have the right character. It's very important to be compassionate, merciful, to have a rahmah. Rahmah in Islam is a neglected practice these days, unfortunately, amongst the Muslims. The Prophet ﷺ, upon whom he peace said, indeed God is compassionate and he loves compassion. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said that love for nas and nas, love for people, or love for yourself. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said you won't taste the fruits of faith, the reality of faith, unless you love for others or you love for yourself in goodness. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said that you should be merciful to the creatures on the earth so the Creator can be merciful to you. This is the paraphrase. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said to his own wife, O Aisha, be compassionate, be kind. When there's compassion and kindness in something, it elevates it. When you remove compassion and kindness, it degrades it, it makes it ugly. So this is very important, the way we talk to people has to be with compassion, with rahmah, with sincerity and mercy. At the same point, don't answer all the questions. Look at Yusuf alayhi salam, Joseph in the Quran. When he was put in the prison, and the prisoners asked him about the interpretation of the dream, how did he answer first? He never interpreted the dream straight away. He spoke about Allah. He spoke about the belief in one God and that he deserves to be worshipped. He went straight to the foundations. So when you talk to non-Muslims, talk to them about the foundations of Islam. It allows them to see the world the way you see the world. They'll have the right tinted glasses. There's no point saying the wall is green when you've got green tinted glasses, but the guy's got red tinted glasses and he's saying it's red. The way to understand each other is to swap glasses, make them see the world the way you see the world, and that's by understanding the foundations of our faith. So you show them that Allah exists, he deserves to be worshipped. You show them the Quran is from Allah. You show them the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is the final prophet. If you could establish as a firm foundation, then whatever comes from truth is true. Whatever comes from haqq is haqq. Whatever comes from truth is true. So use compassion and bring people to the foundations. They'll understand the way, the world, the way you see the world. Final question. Yes, sir.
You know, I think his name was a Hood Boy or something like that. Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
I was watching this video, and like I think you guys got in an argument or something like that. Like, did you talk to him after that or?
No, I haven't.
But like, why did he get angry?
He got angry because I said to him that he hates the Muslim world.
Well, like you know, why'd you say that? Like,
because I think he does.
And what made you think that?
I shouldn't have said it though, because it was in Pakistan, and to accuse him of such things, it could get him killed. So I did apologize. I shouldn't have said it. And when he tried to attack me for saying it, my mind went blank, and I said I didn't say that. And then I remembered saying it. But the thing is, with Professor Hoodboy, he is what you call a scientific rationalist. He wrote the book Religion and Rationality, and I read the book. And I agree with some things he had to say, but the way he was belittling religion and Islam shows his weakness about Islam. And I think he's misunderstood the narrative. But it's neither here nor there, that question, really. No, we live and learn from our experiences, because I had a debate with him at his university in Pakistan. But we make dua for people that Allah guides them and makes it easy for them. And we all, obviously we want him to be safe. So I shouldn't have said that, really. You know, but when you have debates, sometimes it's the heat of the moment and you say things that you shouldn't say. And, you know, he did his fair share of naughty things as well. But yeah, you live and learn. But the point is to get this question, to make it into a wider question. I think that debate and scenario is exactly what we're talking about here today, where people don't understand each other. It's because they come from certain perspectives without really wanting to sit down properly and being sincere to understand people's perspectives. Like Professor Hoodboy, he made some really basic logical fallacies, really basic mistakes. Like he was saying the why and the how is the same, essentially. Because when he was accusing the Quran of saying wrong things, he was assuming the Quran was saying the how, but it wasn't, he was talking about the why. You remember what we said earlier today about the how and the why? He made that basic mistake. You see, he made a basic mistake. And this is why we as Muslims should encourage people to think. Just because you got a degree doesn't mean you can think. Maybe you got good memory. Yeah? We need to be thinkers and get people to think that way. Bi-iznillah. In a humble, with humility. It's very important to be humble, because humility is extremely important. We learn this from Musa alayhi salam, Moses, and Khidr, the famous chapter in the Quran, chapter 18. You know, look at the maqam of Moses. The status of Moses is very high. But he knew that Khidr was given wisdom from God that he wasn't given. So he was very humble to him. And Khidr reminds him that Moses won't be patient with him. So there's two things we learn from that story. When you read the story and understand that to gain wisdom and knowledge, you have to be humble and you have to be patient. So if you learn anything today, to learn things and to gain more knowledge, be humble and be patient. With that note, guys, I'm off. I'm jet lagged. I'm tired. Try and come this weekend. You won't regret it. May God bless you guys. Make sure you're together in compassion as a community. Make sure you show a lot of compassion to the wider society, to the non-Muslims. Because non-Muslims are in need of compassion from the Muslims. We need to create a compassionate society. As Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, he said, the 14th century theologian, where you see rahmah, you must see Islam. Where you see mercy, you should see Islam. So God bless you. And God bless everybody else. Assalamu alaikum.
Hey guys, just quick, tomorrow, no, it's actually Saturday and Sunday is a workshop. Okay, we're going to carpool from here. If any